Group Summer School, Monday afternoon, 21st June, 1982. The question here is, do you know what food or drink supplies the brain with the correct sugar? As regards drink, water as well as any alcoholic drink or beverage does not supply sugar. All other foods, whether they be preponderantly carbohydrates or proteins and fats, also contain a certain amount of carbohydrates. The carbohydrates are converted into sugar. And sugar, you see, is either dextrose or levulose. And that is converted into glucose inside the body once it goes in. And that glucose is carried by the bloodstream to the brain and supplies it with the necessary sugar, the right sort of sugar. So practically everything we eat, to some degree or other, supplies the brain with the correct sugar, but carbohydrates particularly. And sugar itself, if you take the ordinary sugar which we have on the dinner table, that is no good, because that sugar is converted into alcohol. You see, the process is a long and a somewhat complex process. The carbohydrates are converted into glucose by a process of oxidation. And once the sugar is formed and is in the bloodstream, it will go to the brain quite swiftly. But if you take sugar directly, it undergoes the next stage of oxidation, which converts it into alcohol, C2H5OH. You see, as the chemical formula goes. And that's no good for the brain. The next question is, what is the best treatment for physical illness? If body, mind, and spirit are one, should one see a doctor, a priest, or a psychoanalyst? You pays your penny and you takes your choice. Do what you like. See all three of them if you wish. One must be quite sensible about this. If there is a physical illness as such, well, obviously, call in the doctor, whether he be of the allopathic following, or whether he be a nature curist, or whoever he may be. And sometimes your doctor may have to be a masseur or osteopath or whoever he is. They all have their skills which are useful in so many ways. For a great many illnesses, fasting helps a lot. Keep away from food and find out for yourself by experiment what suits you particularly. For instance, some people will just abstain from all food but will take plenty of fruit juice. It helps them. you have to do a good deal of experimenting to find out what is the best for you. A priest, if he is truly a good priest, is also a good psychologist. He can be helpful, but I don't know whether this applies particularly to physical illness as such. It may or it may not. So that's as much as I can say on that question. The next question is, we seem to be living at a time of change. Whatever time we live in is a time of change. I mean, there is no period in life, individual life, as well as the life of the world, where there isn't constant change going on. That goes on all the time. But I think the implication here is of radical change or very considerable change, a change which is much more noticeable than at another period of history. All the old and established standards of behavior are breaking down. Religious and moral standards are deteriorating. Values are crumbling, etc., etc. Are we about to witness a new upthrust of civilization? And if so, in which direction is it likely to go? And there is a quotation from Tennyson, "The old order changeth, giving place to new." Yes. Are we about to witness a new upthrust of civilization? The answer to that partly depends upon what we understand by civilization. More speedy cars and planes, more gadgets and all that sort of thing? Or do we mean a better order of society which has its own criteria and standards which are an advance upon what went before? It depends upon what we mean by civilization. As we all know, since the last war, there has been tremendous upheaval in all departments of life. And as the questioner says, there has been so much deterioration and the crumbling of values. At the same time, it is very noticeable that groups are arising, groups of serious-minded people who do want to see something better, and who have also a certain degree of insight and some vision of how things could change for the better, you see. Now, the direction in which it is likely to go, if there is to be a new civilization springing up, There won't be any one direction in the change. Change will take place with the whole of life and the whole of society. It will take place in all directions. If there is, as the questioner says, an upthrust of civilization. Otherwise, if it's a case of six to the one and half a dozen of the other, you're always on square one. And in a sense, we have to remain on square one all the time. If we move in one direction, through our preferential choice as against another direction, we will find just as much trouble in the new direction, by moving in the new direction, as when we stuck in the old state of affairs. Because life is a whole. It is a unitary whole. And if we neglect that fact, we neglect the most important factor, which is concerned with development and progress. What man has lacked throughout the centuries has been this absence of wholeness in his awareness of life and human relationships and so on. And not only human relationships between living people, but relationships with the whole world, the world of nature, with the world of what we call mechanical progress and all the rest of it. The entire world is wholly interrelated and interactive. This we must really understand. It's quite easy to say these words, and if we hear them or read them, to say, oh yes, yes, that is so, I accept that, I believe that. And then we just carry on in the same old way, which is the way of confusion, of conflict and destruction. So that way there is no progress. It is this change of consciousness which is the most important thing. And a real upthrust of civilization in the finest sense of the word, can only take place if there is this change of consciousness. People don't realize that merely accepting an idea carrying out a particular technique is not the whole story. What a human being is really conscious of is what will be expressed in his thought and feeling, in his speech and his action. And that thought and feeling, speech and action, will be quite natural and spontaneously expressed by him all along the line. It is that which affects the real living transformation of the old. Merely having an idea or just a goal in the distance, that is the thing we must strive for, is more or less impotent. After all, what are our ideals? They are the result of the essence we have extracted out of our own ideas about things. But are our own ideas about things true to the reality of things? This is what people miss out. If the idea corresponds fully with the reality which is present now, the what is, as Krishnamurti says, you see, if it corresponds, then if we become truly conscious of that idea, and it is not a mere string of words inside our brains, then the creative power to effect that change comes out of us, and we are able to make the change in the right way. And that is real progress, that is growth. But we must be truly conscious of the thing. This is a point that very few people understand. They say, oh, so-and-so has said this, let's all go and do it. You can't do it. But when you are really conscious of the actuality, that the truth, the power of what you have heard or seen written or read or whatever it is, then you have the power within yourself to effect the right sort of change. That the real transformation takes place then. So the direction in which the change is likely to go will be in all directions. It will take place mechanically, it will take place spiritually, it will take place in all our techniques of living and everywhere, and in every way. It's the wholeness of life that we have to get hold of. Now, the next question is, why is it that the human psyche seems more attracted to and dwells considerably longer on negative things as opposed to positive things? Now, if by negative things we mean something like this, that somebody behaves in a discourteous or unpleasant manner to us, towards us, that is something negative, and one remembers that throughout the day, or maybe broods upon it for several days and so forth. The human psyche seems attracted to that and dwells upon it, meaning, I suppose, thinks about it, and it's like a little canker somewhere which keeps on hurting one. And positive things are not remembered in the way that negative things are remembered. I wonder if our own self-esteem is involved in this question. Somebody has been nasty to me. He has hurt me. What on earth does he mean by behaving like that? Why did he behave like that? You see, these questions arise. And if somebody is pleasant to me, says a very pleasant good morning, how are you, and smiles, then we just give the answer, and it is out of our consciousness, so to say. Though, and that is the positive thing. But then that is defining the positive as that which is pleasant for us, isn't it? But life in its wholeness is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. It is we who give that interpretation because of our psychophysical reaction to the stimulus. Now, if we are truly observant, that is to say, we look at the outward reality as it, and try to penetrate it completely as it is, and at the same time are free of any reaction from our own brains. I have said this so often. You will notice that when you are experiencing something or observing something, the brain is constantly talking back. It never stops doing that. Oh yes, I agree with that. I don't agree with that. I think that's awful. That's lovely. And so on. And associated with that are all sorts of other reactions. Oh, that's nice. I'll have it. I'll try and do that. If it is not nice, I'll smash it. You see? So, if we can observe completely with our whole being, without reacting, without the brain talking back at it, passing judgments in favor or against, neither approving nor disapproving, neither condemning or applauding, you see, then there is the chance to see the thing for what it actually is. We very rarely see, observe any of our experience for what they experiences for what they actually are, because of this sort of psychical reaction. If the psychical reaction stops and one is perfectly quiet within oneself, then one sees accurately. Now here one can learn something from the technique of the scientist. Throughout the centuries, not so many centuries, it's more or less fairly recent after all, modern modern science. The scientist has prided himself on observing dispassionately, you see, and objectively, as he calls it. Now, where most experimental work is concerned, in the ordinary way, certainly on the macroscopic scale, the big scale, in a laboratory or a factory or wherever it is, the scientist is more or less objective. He observes, he sees just what happens and makes a compendious writes out a compendious description of what he has seen. And on the whole, that works. And it has worked for the last three or four centuries in the world of science. But even the scientist sometimes is not dispassionate. He reads into the observation, the experimental observation, his own subjective view of the thing. It was Eddington who pointed that out very clearly in his Turner lectures at Cambridge in 1938, that scientists imagine that they are observing absolutely dispassionately, but actually their particular bias comes into the story. And he gave the example of a fisherman, and how he uses a net. If the net is made of big meshes, all the little fish will get through. Only the big fish will remain. But if it's a very fine mesh, then he'll catch all the fish. And it's the same with the scientist as he observes. It depends upon his particular mesh. And it also depends on what he wants to find out. In the wanting to find out, there is quite often with any scientist, quite often the desire to look for that which will prove his particular preconception about the fact or the nature of the experiment which is going on. Now, you know, this is very natural to all human beings. We are all like that. For instance, when we read a book for some sort of information. Have you noticed how you read through quickly, looking for what you want to see there, which confirms one's own view? So you see, the whole question of self-esteem comes into the situation. Oh, I was right, so-and-so has said this, and so forth. So we have to be very careful of all that. Now, why is it that the human psyche does this sort of thing? Well, as I have already suggested, it satisfies our own vanity and egoism. Ah, I was quite right, wasn't I? I told you so. That is one of the elements. And one other element which comes to my mind at the moment is simply that we are so ignorant that we can't help doing that. That is all. We are undisciplined, untrained, and we cannot help doing that sort of thing. And the memory of a hurt is rather longer lived on the whole than the memory of the nice things that anybody else has done for us. I don't know to what extent that is true of all human beings, but it seems to me there is that tendency, because the memory of how somebody has hurt us makes a convenient object on which to throw the blame for what happens later on in life. If only so-and-so, my father or my friend or my teacher, had not done this, that or the other 60 years ago, I wouldn't have gone through all that trouble and difficulty and misery and so forth, and been like this today. That's a very natural thing. Natural simply because we are undeveloped. You see, we haven't died to the past. That is one of the things we have to learn to die to completely. We must die to the past. But there is an art in that dying. It is not dying in the sense of the dead creature which has to be buried or cremated. It's not in that sense. This is a very different sort of dying. It's a very intelligent procedure, which is a healing procedure. Perhaps in that other question, what is the best treatment for physical illness? If body, mind and spirit are one, should one see a doctor, priest or psychoanalyst? Well, if one knows how to die to the illness, then one doesn't need to see either doctor or priest or psychoanalyst. I don't know whether I can say any more on this matter, which is useful. Now, the next question. Many of the scriptures of the world present the transcendent in terms of a trinity. As far as Christianity is concerned, could you please explain the meaning of the terms the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost? And explain why they are spoken of as a trinity. You will find that this idea of the Trinity derives from very ancient times. I wouldn't be surprised if this idea of the Trinity isn't somewhat intimately related to our physical experience in everyday life. Father, mother, and child. That is the biological Trinity. And the tendency for man, throughout the ages, mind you, when I say throughout the ages, I mean to at least 6,000 or 7,000 years ago. Before that, goodness knows what men thought and felt and how they expressed things. We tend to transpose our experience and our outlook into a divine and a transcendent sphere. We have this remarkable old hermetic saying, as above, so below. But we human beings have a very strong tendency to plaster the below on the above. Look at the way we talk of God as a supreme being. They are all human terms. All loving, human terms, human experiences, human states and qualities, apotheosized, taken to their nth degree, so to say. You see, human beings love, human beings have some knowledge, so God is all love, God is omniscient, and human beings have power, and they can dominate, and this, that, and the other. God is the almighty, the omnipotent, and so forth. And our imagination is drawn into the picture, and we think of the idea, that we present the idea of God in all sorts of queer ways. When one lives the holy life, in the real sense of the word, all our preconceptions and assumptions, all our tendencies to ascribe to the transcendent realm what holds good in our ordinary worldly realm is very strong, that tendency. So we have to beware of that. Now, Christianity and Hinduism and Egyptian religion has had its trinities. Zarathustrianism doesn't present things in terms of a trinity. The idea of God, Ahura Mazda, Lord of life, life in the sense of power, creative power, and wisdom. Mazda is wisdom, you see. Ahura Mazda has his six archangels. Those archangels are expressions, archetypal forms in which the creative power of Ahura Mazda expresses itself. And it expresses itself as Vahumano, the divine mind, the perfect mind. Ashui as righteousness, Armaiti as divine devotion, Hauravatat as perfect holiness, health, wholeness, and Ameritat as immortality. That makes, how many did I say? Five. I'm sorry, I should have, I've forgotten the sixth name. But there's so much to remember in these things that sometimes one slips. Now, Zarathustrianism presents God not as a trinity, but as the one supreme being possessed of these attributes, of these capacities. We must understand them as different archetypal forms in which the one primordial creative energy finds expression in our lives and in the cosmos insofar as we are able to perceive the cosmos. Look at it that way. They are not creatures flying through the air, flapping golden wings or whatever you like. You see, they are just energies at work, and they are very real energies, because for whatever energy we have in our own personal life, it has its cosmic, universal counterpart. That same kind of energy, or a similar kind of energy, of a transcendent nature, not of a physical, worldly nature, functions through the totality. And when it functions through us in the forms that we recognize for ourselves, these are the reflections, if you like, of that universal cosmic energy. You see? And this is where we find ourselves easily going wrong. We use words which hold good for our human state and apply them to transcendence itself. But we have no concept. We cannot form a concept of that which is transcendent, for the very simple reason that the context of the transcendent is the context of infinity, eternity, immortality. Can you tell me what is eternity? Can I tell you what is eternity? Can I tell you what is infinity? Not finitude. The immeasurable. The illimitable. You see, all the words I'm saying are words which contradict what we ordinarily know in our everyday life: limitation, finiteness, measurability. Isn't that so? You can measure only that which is limited, and so forth. So when we use these terms, we are trying to present in apotheosis that which belongs to our particular sphere, the worldly sphere, which is the sphere of the finite, the temporal and mortal. Limited manifestation, time and mortality, death. Whereas universally, cosmically, transcendentally, these are all contradicted. But the transcendent context completely holds this limited context. This limited context is wholly subsumed in the transcendent context. Now look, there is one way of getting the feel of this thing. You take a point, the pure point. What do we mean by a pure point, mathematically, for instance? That which has neither length, nor breadth, nor depth. The three dimensions of space of which we are conscious can be presented as length, depth, and breadth. Width, isn't that so? And each of these dimensions is at right angles to the other two dimensions. This is as far as our consciousness at its present state can go. Now, if you take the point, it has neither length, depth, nor breadth. It is immeasurable. You can't measure such a thing materially. There is no material existence to it as such. And therefore, it is not finite, not measurable. Therefore, it belongs to the context of the transcendent, actually. Now, you can't take countless points and put them side by side and make a straight line, because you'll always have a gap between two successive points. You see? But if that point suddenly comes to life and moves, it will make a line. Now, when it stops moving, it has made a finite line. So you see, the infinite, by self-constriction, becomes the finite. Now, if you can brood over this sort of thing, you will begin to get a feel, just a feel, a touch of what transcendence implies and means, and this transcendent context. So now, to come back to this, as far as Christianity is concerned, presented as a trinity. This is a transposing from our ordinary experience of father, mother, and child to God. And it's the same thing in Hinduism, but in a slightly different form. You get the three persons of the Trinity in Hinduism as Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva. In Christianity, it's Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. In the Egyptian form, it's Isis, Osiris, Horus. You see, and Isis is the female element, the mother element. And don't forget that in one of the uncanonical Gospels, it is said that Jesus, when he came out of the Jordan, said, amongst other things, "My mother, the Holy Ghost," treating the Holy Ghost as the principle which can be fecundated and therefore produce the whole world, the universe. A similar idea prevails in Hindu teaching also. Now, to explain the Father, the Son, I can't explain the Father in terms of transcendence, or the Son, or the Holy Ghost. No words would be true to the reality. whatever that reality is. It is the one unitary whole which, expressing itself this way, we term the Father, that way the Son, that way the Holy Ghost. And they are all completely contained in the one total reality. That is how I see it. I may be hopelessly wrong, and I dare say Christian theologians would say the man's talking nonsense. And they may be right. Now the last question. If the enlightenment of Jesus happened after the temptation in the wilderness, what then is the deep meaning of the crucifixion and the resurrection? It's a tremendous question. And shall we reserve it for Thursday? Let us reserve that question for Thursday. It's a very good question, but it needs careful exposition. That is, assuming I can expound it. Thank you.